This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. David Granite, and welcome to Health Matters. Today, we're going to have sort of an interesting discussion about two topics that will come together, but at first glance sound differently, and that is a new way to approach your appointment with a physician to get more out of it, and specifically when you have a problem with your liver that might be something like hepatitis C. Well, who do you find in one person that can talk about both of those things? We have with us the perfect expert, Dr. Alexander Kuo. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Kuo is an associate clinical professor here at UC San Diego, where he's director of hepatology and medical director for liver transplantation.
Correct.
Those are long titles, and you have a great experience, and I'm so glad you had a few minutes to come share with us. I mentioned getting more out of a medical appointment. In this day and age, time is being crunched. Efficiency matters. Patients come in. They may have a lot of questions. You've kind of helped sort of figure out a way to redesign the medical appointment.
Yes.
What have you been doing?
Well, you know, this is a pilot program that the School of Medicine started about a year and a half ago called a shared medical appointment. And the idea behind this is to allow patients to have more time with doctors like me. As you know, as a busy clinician, the standard medical visit is very, very rushed. You'll be lucky to have 10 or 20 minutes with your doctor, and that's actually a good visit. And a lot of information needs to be transmitted in a very small amount of time. I deal with patients that have very advanced liver disease, cirrhosis. They're in need of liver transplant. They're on the waiting list, or they're thinking about getting on the waiting list. And I found that my 20-minute office visits just weren't enough. They weren't enough for me. I felt like I was doing a disservice to the patients. There was just too much I needed to get across to them. And it was a disservice to the patients because they left the appointments with fragmented information, incomplete information, and they always wanted more. And rather than have them come back in 6 or 8 weeks where we continue the conversation, it would have been a better model if I can spend more time with the patients. But as you know, the payers are not paying for 90-minute office visits.
No.
We're lucky to get pennies on the dollar of what we bill. And so a new model needed to be created. And so when the School of Medicine leadership approached all the division heads and said, you know, we have this pilot program of a shared medical appointment, I jumped on it and I said, I want to be one of the first clinics to do this. And so we launched this about a year and a half ago. I've tailored this special clinic just to patients with advanced liver disease cirrhosis. Those on the list are considering being on the list. And I sprinkle a few patients that have already undergone transplant so that patients can see what things are like, you know, after the surgery, so it sort of demystifies that process.
So they have an opportunity together to ask you questions.
Correct.
How big a group?
I keep them pretty small. I usually have between 5 and 8 patients, and each patient can bring a guest. Usually it's their spouse or significant other, or their caregiver. And we hold the meeting in a conference room in our clinic space. And as patients check in, they get their vital signs taken as usual by the medical assistants, and then we have them sign a privacy and confidentiality form. Both the patients and the guests sign this form, so nothing that is discussed in the shared medical appointment leaves that room. And then everybody is sort of seated in a semicircle, and I'm at the front of the room with an empty chair. And I have two assistants. I have two wonderful RNs that we've trained. One who is the medical scribe, and so it frees me up from doing that onerous progress note. Then I have another RN who's the facilitator, whose job it is to engage the group in a discussion about the different topics that come up.
Are you examining the patients during that time?
I am. So this is often a common fear among patients that they're going to be having to disrobe in front of an audience, and that's not true. And so for the most part, I do focus physical exams, listen to heart and lungs, I palpate their abdomen, examine the legs for edema. This is all done fully clothed. In the rare instance that I need to do a more extensive exam that requires disrobing, we will take the patients out to a private exam room after the group visit is over. And so there's no risk of embarrassment during these visits.
This sounds sort of incredible to me, that you get the people together, because now you have a longer period of time.
Correct.
And you can go into depth in topics. And I also assume there's some value to people hearing other patients asking a question that either they didn't think of, were embarrassed to ask,
right,
and that their caregivers get to hear that other caregivers might have a similar question.
You hit the nail on the head. And so there are a lot of advantages, potential advantages to this type of a model. This is a 90-minute session, right? And so, you know, for an hour and a half, patients will be getting a lot of information that they otherwise, you know, would require 5 or 6 office visits to get. And because I sort of cohort similar diagnoses together, there's a lot of bang for the buck. There's a lot of yield. They're not sitting through other patients' appointments that have nothing to do with them. They all have cirrhosis.
Yeah.
And they're all dealing with the same complications like fluid retention and confusion and liver cancer and anxiety about waiting for a liver transplant. And so they all have similar fears. By allowing them 90 minutes, their individual one-on-one session might take 10 minutes, but they can stay. They're encouraged to stay for the entirety of the 90-minute session. And so, as you say, not only do I give them information about their specific case, but they learn about other examples, other patients that are going through the same thing. And every visit, there's patients that have thought of questions that their next-door neighbor hadn't thought of, and they leave that visit more informed than they otherwise would have been.
How valuable. That's really incredible. It's not a traditional support group, but you can't help but get some support out of that.
There are elements of this. And so, the feedback I'm getting from my patients for the most part is that they really enjoy this. And they enjoy it not just because they get more information from me. And it's not just the traditional one-way communication of a didactic lecture from the professor or the doctor spewing information at the patient, but they're learning from each other, right? So they're learning from other patients. The caregivers are learning about how to deal with chronic disease. And so it makes my job much easier because I sort of plant the seeds and then the group sort of runs with things. But as you mentioned, the support group component of this does exist. But I do want to say that this is not a support group.
Understood.
This is a standard medical appointment just in a group setting, right?
Yeah.
But the patients and their caregivers, they lend a lot of support to each other.
Do you typically have the same people coming back for appointments? So it's this group of 6 people will come back and see you again in 2 months? Or is it mix and match different groups?
It's a little bit mixed. It sort of depends on the acuity of the disease. That determines the frequency of the follow-ups. And so one thing that's important to know is this is an optional value-added service to our patients. This doesn't replace the standard traditional one-on-one visit unless the patients prefer it. And I actually have several patients that prefer the group model. But if you join the shared medical appointment for 1 or 2 or 3 sessions and you feel like, you know, I've gotten what I needed out of it and I want to go back to the one-on-one, that option is available to them as well.
Do you have people requesting to be in that process?
I do. I have so little free time, so it's actually difficult for me to sort of promote this clinic. And so we do have some marketing materials, brochures, flyers on the clinic. But once they've heard about it, everybody's interest is piqued. And so I would say 80 to 90% of patients that I approach about this new model are interested and they try it at least one time.
I picture your waiting room in a normal day having a couple of people who have done this telling the other patients about how great it was.
Correct. You know, and then there's been a few patients that that we've sort of engaged to spread the word about the shared medical appointment because they really feel it's a positive experience. And so we're getting the word out. This is not a new model. This has been across the country, different clinical practices have used the shared medical appointment over the last 20 years. But it's, I think, slowly picking up steam recently.
Have you, putting on your academic hat, have you collected data about whether or not this impacts compliance, outcomes, patient satisfaction?
Yeah. So we haven't done those things specifically in our clinics. There's a lot of data that shows that patient satisfaction scores skyrocket with this model. As you can imagine, they get 90 minutes with their doctors.
Unheard of.
And access is also important, too. And so there are some clinics where access is a problem. Their next available appointment to see the expert is 2, 3, 4 months in the future. But when you're sick, you want to see the doctor now. And so a shared medical appointment potentially can allow that, where you can have a drop-in visit in the shared medical setting, which really helps patients in terms of access and patient satisfaction.
I hadn't even thought about that. I mean, in your normal day, if somebody needs to drop in, that you have to find a 20-minute gap somewhere, which doesn't exist, and then
right.
you're running late. But you've sated that one patient, but you've annoyed everybody else. But in a shared clinic, if you have six people or seven people, it doesn't change it.
It doesn't change it that much. It's much more flexible. I can see five, I can see eight, and I'm able to accommodate that extra person.
It sounds like there's some significant positives that can spin off. And I have a feeling that we're going to see lots of ideas like this as we continue into the future of medicine, taking this forward. Now, you said that you have... patients with significant liver issues that you've clumped together for these shared medical visits. And one of the things that you spend a lot of time with is hepatitis C patients who might end up in these shared medical visits and talking about with liver problems.
Yes.
So I think that I'd love to segue into those problems that you spend those shared medical visits talking about. But to do that, I wanted to start off with, where is the liver? What is the liver? What does it do?
Sure, liver 101.
Yeah, right? A little bit.
So the liver is the largest abdominal organ, and it's about the size of a football. It's behind your ribs on the right side. It's a very complicated organ. This is the reason why I went into hepatology, because there's a lot of unknowns in the liver. But it does so many things. It doesn't just do one thing. It filters the blood. It clears the blood of toxins, other chemicals that otherwise would sort of poison you. It is a warehouse. It stores energy. And so as you eat food, your body uses a little bit of energy. The rest of the energy is stored in your liver. It's also a factory. It produces all the proteins in your blood, like albumin. It produces all the clotting factors in your blood, so you don't, you stop bleeding when you get a cut. And so there are a lot of things that the liver does, and it's sometimes it's hard to encapsulate it in one statement.
Yeah, it's funny because no matter who I have on the show, the passion they have for what they do comes out immediately as they start talking. And
right.
you're talking about the liver, with a little bit of awe and a little bit of wonderment.
Yes.
But it's so very obvious that you love talking about this and thinking about this organ. You know, it just jumps out of you. So the like everything else, sometimes things go wrong. The one we're talking about in specific now is something called hepatitis. And then there are subsets of hepatitis. Talk us through that.
Well, hepatitis, all that means is inflammation in the liver. But there are a lot of things that can cause hepatitis. One of the most common problems in the United States for chronic liver disease is hepatitis C. This is a viral infection. This is a blood-borne infection. It's spread by contaminated needles or contaminated blood. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people in the United States and a lot of people around the world that have this infection. It is... responsible for a lot of healthcare costs. The expense of treating patients that have advanced liver disease from hepatitis C is overwhelming. And the projections for the number of patients that are going to progress to advanced cirrhosis, which is scarring of the liver from hepatitis C, is going to be a tidal wave of disease in the next 15 to 20 years, unless we can do something to stop the natural history of this disease, which is hopefully we'll be talking about some of these new exciting drugs that we have coming out.
Yeah, absolutely. Hepatitis C implies there's a hepatitis A and B.
Right.
So just for the audience to separate out what the differences are, because somebody might say I have hepatitis, but they're not all the same.
Correct. And so they're all distinct diseases. There's hepatitis A, B, C, D, E, G. So there's a number of different viral
hepatitises. I'm laughing
because
when I started in medical school, it was A, B, non-AB.
Right.
We knew there were others, but we didn't have all these subcategorized.
Right,
it's amazing how medicine marches on.
So viral hepatitis, as you know, they're not all created equal. They're all different diseases, and they have different mechanisms of spread, and they all have different effects on your liver. So hepatitis C is a difficult infection to spread or to acquire. Really is bloodborne, and it causes a chronic infection in the liver. Once you get it, for the most part, once the disease is established, you can't get rid of it unless you're treated with drugs. A disease like hepatitis A is actually a very common disease. This is a foodborne illness usually. It's spread through contaminated food that you ingest, and it causes, for the most part, a self-limited diarrheal illness where you're sick for a few days. In severe cases, you might be jaundiced, but the symptoms resolve within 1 or 2 weeks. There is no chronicity to hepatitis A, but hepatitis B and hepatitis C do lead to chronic liver disease.
And hepatitis C, you've said several times it's bloodborne. If my kid gets a cut, is that how he gets it, or is this blood transfusions?
Well, there are certain risk factors. And so most people in the United States that have hepatitis C, there are about 3 to 5 million people, first of all, just in the United States. Around the world, there are about 200 million people that have hepatitis C. Most people in the United States, their risk factors are pretty clear. History of injection drug use, history of blood transfusions before 1992, that's when the blood supply was tested for hepatitis C, tattoos from dirty needles, hemodialysis, and so there are certain groups that have increased risk. The CDC earlier in 2013 released recommendations for birth cohort screening, which is baby boomers, basically. And so anybody born between 1945 and 1965, this cohort, regardless of whether they have identifiable risk factors for hepatitis C, the CDC recommended at least a one-time screening for hepatitis C because the prevalence of disease is 5 times higher in that birth cohort than the general population.
Is that because for such a large part of their life, the blood supply was not screened?
Partially, but it probably had more to do with lifestyle and that experimentation with drugs in your teens and 20s and 30s, that they're in their 50s and 60s and 70s, they might have forgotten what they did when they were younger.
Yes.
and also, physicians have a reluctance to ask about these risk factors, and oftentimes patients are embarrassed to reveal their history.
So by making an automatic screening,
correct,
you get around all of that.
Correct.
I want to make sure that we take a second to say this clearly and out loud. Is the blood supply today safe?
Very safe, very safe. And so all blood that's donated is tested for a variety of viruses, including hepatitis C. The risk of transmission for hepatitis C through an infected unit of blood is well north of 1 in a million chance.
Okay. So the person giving the blood has no risk, right? So nobody has to be worried that when they give blood that there's
correct,
a problem. And the person receiving it, driving in their car, is more risky than getting the blood.
Absolutely.
Okay. So now we go to what you talked about before, which is if you get a chronic problem, you want to stop it before it destroys your liver or causes cirrhosis and you need a transplant.
Right.
What are the standard approaches we've had up till now? And then let's get to the cool new things that we have available.
Sure. So the big problem with hepatitis C is that it's an asymptomatic disease. Most people that have hepatitis C, they don't know they have it. They feel well. They're going about their lives. They're raising kids and they're going about their jobs. And it's only when the disease is very advanced, when the amount of inflammation and scarring has reached a tipping point where the liver becomes hard from all the accumulation of scar tissue. And that hardening of the liver is what we call cirrhosis of the liver. Even people that have early cirrhosis usually have no symptoms. It's only when people have advanced cirrhosis that they start exhibiting the obvious symptoms we all learn in medical school, like a protuberant abdomen full of fluid in the belly, jaundice, yellow eyes, yellow skin, mental confusion from all those toxic chemicals that are not being cleared by the liver, or developing liver cancer and presenting with weight loss, those types of symptoms.
But yet you want to catch them when they're early.
We do want to catch them when they're early.
When they have no symptoms.
Correct, correct. And so we want to interrupt the natural history of chronic hepatitis C. And the only way to do that right now is to treat people with drugs. And up until recently, the drugs have been, one, fraught with a lot of side effects, and two, not as effective at curing patients as we would like. And I do want to take this time to tell people that hepatitis C is curable. There's a cure, right? And it's amazing how many patients, even under my care, that they're not aware of that. They think that there's treatments, but there's not a cure. We can cure, and we do cure people with hepatitis C. The old drugs, the standard of care was a very difficult medication called interferon alpha, which was an injection that we had to teach patients how to give to themselves, sort of like diabetics give themselves insulin, where they inject it under their skin once a week. It's been difficult to take this medication because it causes flu-like symptoms, fatigue, increases the risk of depression, anxiety. And so a lot of patients really dislike this medication. And for most people that have hepatitis C, the cure rate with a year's treatment of these medications was less than 50%.
Wow. And so you had a hard time getting them early.
Correct.
And identifying them. Now we do a little bit better job identifying people earlier now in their internal medicine doctor's office.
We do, but we need to get the word out even more as physicians that hepatitis C is a public health problem and that everybody within that birth cohort or that have risk factors like injection drug use, incarceration, blood transfusions need to be tested. And so this is a larger problem in our public health system is that we need to identify all these people before they get too old, before they progress to cirrhosis. Once we identify them, we actually have a lot of new treatments to offer.
Were there people who were afraid of the old treatments that they really didn't want to go through them?
Yes. So twofold. There were patients that just weren't candidates for the old treatment. Let's say they had severe psychiatric illness like bipolar disorder or uncontrolled depression. If we gave them interferon, they could become suicidal. There are patients that have advanced liver disease, like very advanced cirrhosis, where interferon therapies would be dangerous. It would actually tip the liver over into failure. And precipitate other complications.
I mean, the end cost to this is a transplant or death.
Correct.
And so it's very expensive, both to the person and society. Screening is cheap by comparison.
Correct.
And now we have new treatments.
Well, a liver transplant, costs north of $250,000 per transplant. And then there's the added expense of lifetime immunosuppression, lifetime clinic follow-up, blood tests, et cetera. And so if we can treat patients and cure them of their hepatitis C before they progress to needing a transplant, I would be very happy.
Tell us about the new stuff.
Well, this is really exciting. Some of this revolution started in 2011, where there was a new class of medications that were FDA-approved called protease inhibitors. So this is terminology that's similar to the HIV medicine, where now we're using small molecules that are targeted at the machinery that the virus uses to replicate. Okay, so these inhibitors were released in May of 2011. There are two medications that were combined with interferon and ribavirin, the old standard of care, and the cure rates skyrocketed. They went from 40% up to 70%. The problem, though, is that we're still dealing with interferon. And so there was still a large percentage of patients that just were interferon ineligible. They just couldn't tolerate it. And so this was an incremental improvement in our treatments, but not that revolutionary leap that we were all waiting for.
And the new medicines, injections or oral?
The protease inhibitors in 2011 are oral medications that people have to take three times a day. What's been exciting is just at the end of November and the beginning of December, the FDA approved two new medications. And both of these medications are oral once-a-day pills. And for certain populations of patients that have hepatitis C, depending on what strain you have, hepatitis C comes in different strains, genotype 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Depending on what strain you have, a lot of these patients are eligible for interferon-free treatments, where all you're doing is taking pills once or twice a day for as short as 12 weeks of therapy.
Wow.
And now we're curing up to 90% of people.
Game changer.
Game changer. Revolutionary.
And I mean, in the course of your career, you've seen, the development of a treatment, yay, and
right.
then, but it was a tough treatment, and now look what you're moving to. 12
Absolutely.
Weeks, and you're curing someone of hepatitis C?
Absolutely. And then this is the tip of the iceberg in that multiple drug companies are fast and furious trying to develop these new medications. The second and third generation of these new medications, which might be poised to come out at the end of 2014, beginning of 2015, are even more potent. Potentially, we can treat patients with
one pill.
You
threaten the liver with it? I mean, how much more potent is it going to be?
Well, you take one pill once a day for 12 weeks, no matter what genotype, and we're likely going to be able to cure 95 to 100% of people.
Incredible.
It's amazing.
New medications often costly, but I can't imagine it costs more than a liver transplant. I mean,
absolutely true. Cost is going to be an issue. These medications are astronomical in price, but it also costs a lot of money to develop these medications. And so you have to understand the benefit from the drug company to recoup their investments. But at some point, the costs have to come down. And so there's a lot of different groups that are lobbying the pharmaceutical industry to make these medications a little bit more affordable.
Are they covered by insurance? Do people have to worry they can't get it?
For the most part, they are. Because these drugs are so expensive, there's a lot of prior authorization, a lot of hoops that we have to jump through to get these patients covered. But the payers understand the benefits to this, and for the most part, we're getting these drugs covered.
Yeah, they have actuaries who do calculations, and they sit down and they calculate that the liver transplant's X dollars, and
correct,
this is Y dollars, and it's cheaper in the end.
Right.
The answer prevention is always cheaper, even though it's expensive.
If we can cure a patient from their hepatitis C, even if they've already developed cirrhosis of the liver, their long-term survival is improved.
And does the liver regenerate that part of it that was damaged if it's the rest of it's healthy now?
The liver's an amazing organ, as you know. It can heal itself, but when the damage becomes so extensive that patients have developed advanced scarring, advanced cirrhosis, for the most part, the general teaching is that it loses the ability to heal itself.
So earlier, again, if you only part of it has begun to start to change, earlier it might might recover.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
That's incredible. So in the short time that we have left, what do you see the future as? Or what would you like to see the future as? This is the future according to Quo. How would you like to see it go, and how you're going to be involved in directing it in that direction? Where
correct
do you see it going?
Well, I think we're on the right track in terms of drug development. And so now we have the tools. We have the weapons to fight this infection. A lot of our resources now need to be focused on identifying those patients that are infected. And so screening needs to be widespread, right? So once we identify everybody, the challenge is going to be, how do we pay for treating all those 5 million people that have hepatitis C, right? So that's sort of the next sort of frontier in the next 5 to 10 years that the healthcare system is going to have to tackle.
That's sort of a crazy question. I mean, if you think about it, we have a way to help the people, and we have to worry that if we identify too many, it's going to cost too much. But yet, my gosh, the burden, the healthcare burden to the patient, to society, we have to do this.
Correct.
You can't say no to that.
Correct, correct. And as a transplant physician, my passion is liver transplant. And if you look at the indications for transplant in the United States, about 50% of people that get transplant in the United States, adults, are transplanted for hepatitis C. And so I'm waiting for the world where in the near future that we're not transplanting for hepatitis C anymore, which would mean a lot more livers for other patients that there's no shortage of other liver diseases that need transplant, but hepatitis C will start to recede as the leading indication for transplant.
Wouldn't that be great?
That would be wonderful.
I'd love it. Well, thank you for the work you're doing, in your clinic every day in the office, and thank you for spending a few minutes with us in this large shared medical community to talk about some of the really innovative things that are coming down the pipeline, both in the delivery of medical care and the delivery of medical education.
Sure, I really enjoyed it.
Terrific, thank you. You've been listening to Dr. Alexander Quo tell you about some new things that are coming, and I love the idea of the shared medical appointment, because what you have is a new way to think about interacting with your physician and new way of getting information that can be much more valuable. We have to be creative in the coming future. That's the way that our medical care will continue to get better. But even more importantly, there is a cure for hepatitis C, and the treatment is no longer as onerous for some as it used to be. We really have a new era of medicine that we're engaged in. So if you have any history of that or being alive during that time that you heard him talk about, it might be really worthwhile to get screened. Remember, knowledge is power. I'm Dr. David Granite, and this has been Health Matters. We'll see you again next time.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.